Election Day is next Tuesday, but according to the AP, there are already 100 lawsuits, 73 from the Republican National Committee, challenging voting rules, adding to the glut of suits filed about the last election. The RNC has also held 5,000 workshops to train election-denying volunteers to look for voter fraud, which has been almost non-existent. In Arizona, photos showed armed masked men wearing tactical military gear standing watch at a ballot box in Mesa during early voting. Bloomberg News reports on other election deniers confronting voters dropping off ballots in Arizona and Michigan. So what happens now to the Republican Party, which is fostering this fear, to democracy, which depends on free elections? On a recent evening at WBUR's City Space in Boston, Harvard historian Jill Lepore reminded us we can't be nostalgic for other times in history. Before the Voting Rights Act of 1965, it was difficult for Black Americans to even vote.
When huge swaths of the population are disenfranchised, it's actually really meaningless data.
But are we going back to that time? Also on the panel were former Republican strategist Shermichael Singleton and Harvard Law professor Guy Uriel Charles, director of the Charles Hamilton Institute for Race and Justice. I started by asking him what keeps him up at night.
What keeps me up at night is essentially a local replaying of the January 6th events at various polling places or states. The election workers are election deniers. Everybody has questions about the machinery, even though infrastructure works really well, right? Those are the types of things that keep me up.
I think we're already seeing insurrection attempts at the polling places.
Well, we're certainly seeing, at the very least, a precursor. Clearly, we have an attempt to train individuals to get them to be much more combative. And part of the question for me as well is, how will the Democrats respond? So to what extent are we going to have both sides in a pitch battle in a precinct fighting over a voting machine? And if that's the direction that we had, then I fear for American democracy.
Well, sure. And Shermichael Singleton, a former Republican, why'd you leave?
I mean, I think that's an obvious question and answer to that, right? I mean, you know, it became a point in time for me, and I've worked on several presidential campaigns from Gingrich to Romney. You begin to find voters at the base level adopting QAnon and other theories that we know hold no basis of truth. And it's almost impossible to articulate a message against those things.
Jill, that video released by the January 6th committee, taken as the leaders Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer were begging for someone to send the National Guard. Right in that same picture, you see the Republicans Steve Scalise and Kevin McCarthy standing right there while they're making those pleas, even though after this attempted coup, they held press conferences saying Nancy Pelosi didn't try to bring out the National Guard. Has there been another time when this many Americans believed lies?
Polarization has been on the rise since about 1970, and it has consistently risen since that time. So the polarization makes the kind of possible shared reality impossible ultimately as it proceeds. But for historians, the 1850s is the first time that political maps appear where the free states, that is the states where the constitutions have made slavery illegal, are represented in one color, and the so-called slave states are, you know, maybe they're in hash marks or something. And you don't see that again until really after the 2000 election, right? When CNN has introduced the red state, blue state color scheme for color TV. But when you look at the map, it is the same map as the map in the 1850s, right? So if you were to today to map states that if a pro-life constitutional amendment were on the state ballot on as a popular referendum, would favor that versus oppose that, you get a map that is freakishly similar to the divisions in the 1850s. And I don't think that exactly maps on to a proportion of the population that does or does not believe that Trump lost in 2020. But I do think there are deeper ideological commitments that somehow loosely line up with some of those questions. And I think the whole, like, Democrats having to fight against people denying the results of the last election is it just an incredible political loss? That's, to me, the biggest cost there.
Sure.
One of the reasons the parties are weak and don't really cohere, and I think this is true of both parties, is that there's a really kind of declining commitment to the very idea of representation, that you could join a coalition of other people who might be different from you, with whom you do not agree about absolutely everything, in order to agree to kind of pool your interests and choose someone to go represent broadly all of your interests. And you might not get everything you want. Young people in particular, they just can't imagine why they would belong to a party. I mean, they're really committed to a set of ideological purity tests that everybody must pass before they can even come into a room. And that's not how parties work, right? We're in a very painful moment where the parties are not working, and what's replacing the parties is not quite clear. It looks, at the moment, simply dangerous.
Yeah, and the data shows that. I mean, as a strategist, and you look at data of what voters feel and how they feel about the other side, they view the other side as an existential threat to their existence.
Yeah, and I think it's easy to say, oh, the lie, and it started in 2020, but the resistance that starts in 2016 is very much about the existential threat. Like, because Trump's in office, there's this intense escalation where democracy's on the ballot, a phrase that drives me crazy. Democracy is just not on the ballot. Like, if you want to have a calmer politics, someone has to be willing. It's a game of chicken. Someone has to stand down.
I want to take a detour for just a second and ask Jermichael, what do you think happens to the Republican Party? Where does Liz Cheney go?
I mean, I think the Liz Cheneys of the world, the Adam Kinzingers of the world, the Bill Kristols of them, the Michael Steeles, we've tried to form anti-Trump groups. We've tried to form groups of Republicans for democracy. We haven't been effective. I don't see the party disappearing. I think those of us who are, and people say moderate, it's as if we're moderate, we still have very much so conservative dispositions about our ideology. I do not believe the group of us have a fighting chance to transform the party. They're finding within groups, subgroups, where their messaging is palatable. And I use black men as an example because that's a group that I've been really focusing a lot on with the Georgia race. They're looking at black men. They're looking at certain individuals within the Asian community. They're looking at groups of men within the Muslim community. And they're being able to articulate this message that these people are against you, or these people are against this idea of a cultural norm.
Yeah.
Correct. And what you're finding when you look at focus group data on this stuff, people are saying, you know, that's actually true.
Jill, is there a time in history when a party really rose from ashes?
Parties die. They're born and they die. You know,
the
Republican
Party
was born on a day in 1854 in Wisconsin. It will die one day, right? History is very humbling because most things are going to end. Everything's going to end. So I think we could also argue whether the Republican Party is the Republican Party anymore, right? It's in name only. The Republican Party no longer exists as it was defined in some consistent way for a number of decades. And the same is true of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is a totally different party than it used to be. So the bigger question, frankly, is whether the party system continues.
I know you don't think democracy's on the ballot, but people do. Guy Uriel-Charles, can democracy survive?
I'm an optimist by nature. Democracy still remains the best thing that we know for preserving our sense of the good. And so my role in my part is to inculcate that idea in the minds of young people. And I think there are reasons to believe that, yeah, things were difficult in 2020, but our fundamental guardrails still held on.
I don't know if the guardrails will hold on in 2024. And I'm very pessimistic about the future. Look at the focus group data. I look at the complete distrust of every aspect of the system. I am very, very concerned about the country. And I'm not certain if we'll be able to make it the next 4-8 years, depending on who the next president is.
Jill?
In 1937, with fascism on the rise around the world, fascists in power, the New Republic published a forum on the future of democracy, and they asked a number of people to weigh in with essays. And my favorite was by a political philosopher who said, you know, I'm tired of people asking, is democracy going to survive? As if they're asking for a weather report, and they want to know, is if it's going to rain, I'd like to bring an umbrella out. Democracy is not like the weather. It's only like the weather in this way. You go outside and you stop the rain.
Jill Lepore, Harvard historian and New Yorker staff writer. Guy Uriel Charles, professor, Charles Ogletree Chair at Harvard. And Shermichael Singleton, former Republican. All of you, thank you so much for coming to take a look ahead. Thanks, everybody who came and turned out. Thank you at home. Thank you.